Appaloosa Radio offers an original story, Polio, by James Joel Mounts Miller. Bulbospinal poliomyelitis is a disabling and life-threatening disease caused by the spherically shaped poliovirus. Before Jonas Salk and his colleagues developed the first effective vaccines, polio was a widespread and dreaded disease. Infectious disease experts now say that in the later 1940s, the disease had infected at least 50% of the American population. However, most people did not notice it. 72% of those infected had no symptoms. Of those who displayed symptoms, for most, the impact of the disease was very minor, much like a light flu. Still, for 1% of those infected with the poliovirus, the symptoms were much more severe, becoming paralytic polio, poliomyelitis. Paralytic polio could take three forms. 1. It could attack the spine and cause the nerves that control movement of arms and legs to stop firing, or 2. It could attack the brainstem, attacking particularly the nerves that control breathing, or 3. It could attack both the spine and the brainstem, impacting both breathing and muscle movement. This third form is called bulbospinal poliomyelitis. People who contract paralytic polio represent about 1% of those infected with the disease. Of this 1%, only about 1 of every 200 contract bulbospinal poliomyelitis. I was one of those. Polio would impact my entire life. Yet, I have always refused to be defined as a polio patient. I have spent most of my life denying that I am disabled or limited or constrained by that disease. Even as I type these words, my entire being screams, I am not a polio patient. Yet, I was. To a large degree, it made me who I am today. It is time to tell the story, honestly and directly. No anger. No regret. Just as it is. Just as it was. I was in the third grade at Washington Elementary School in Redondo Beach, California. I remember it being warm. My new blue jeans were still stiff and that made me feel hot. I noticed that my throat was sore, and my muscles ached. The night before, I had thrown up my dinner. My mother said I felt feverish. Since she did not drive, she called my Uncle Glenn. He was an air traffic controller at the Los Angeles International Airport, and he worked nights. So, he was available to drive my mother and me to Dr. Hausk's office. He examined me and then made a phone call. I remember sitting in the front seat of my uncle's Oldsmobile, between my mother and my uncle. It was 21 miles from the doctor's office to Los Angeles General Hospital. My mother was frustrated because there were so many red lights. I remember my uncle saying, "It's okay. We're making good time." I remember the massive wooden benches in the hospital's waiting room. At the end of each bench, there was an unusual, decorative metal grate that brought steam heated air into the waiting room. It was already hot, but they were still heating the place. There was a man selling ice cream. I was really hot and I wanted ice cream. My uncle bought me a chocolate-coated ice cream bar, a very special treat. I tried to swallow it, but I could not. The ice cream spilled out of my mouth and down my shirt. My mother went to the restroom and came back with some paper towels to clean me up. Just then a very tall nurse came in and led me to the back. She noticed that I was having extreme difficulty breathing. Someone yelled, "Surgery stat." So, I was admitted to the isolation unit of the polio ward at Los Angeles General Hospital on October 12, 1954, just 11 days before my 8th birthday. They rushed me into surgery and performed an emergency tracheostomy. Essentially, the medical procedure involves creating an opening in the neck for a tube that goes into the windpipe. With the tube in place, air enters the lungs directly bypassing the mouth, nose, and throat. I have a distinct memory from my tracheostomy procedure. I remember someone yelling loudly at another person. I believe that the person yelling was the senior surgeon. He was yelling at, what I presume, was the young resident who just had performed my surgery. That's wrong. Not through the laryngeal prominence. Lower in the cavity at the base of the neck. The young resident was being severely criticized for making the incision through my Adam's apple, the laryngeal prominence, instead of the more preferred location at the base of the neck. While the young resident had created a free path for air to reach my lungs, he had also risked my vocal cords in the procedure. The Adam's apple is a system of cartilage designed, in part, to protect the vocal cords. Ironically, I learned many years later that polio, not this young surgeon, had completely destroyed my left vocal cord. I talk and sing, such that it is, with just my right one. My next distinct memory was being inside an iron lung in the isolation unit of the polio ward. It was late at night, the lighting had been turned down low. A masked nurse wearing surgical clothing, complete with a full, transparent face shield and latex gloves was operating a suction machine, sucking the mucus and other junk out of my breathing tube. It really hurt, like needles going through the inside of my neck. After she was done, she plugged the air hole in my tube, patted me on the head, and told me to go back to sleep. I now believe that until she began to suction me, I was still under the effects of the anesthesia, oblivious to what was happening around me. However, once awake, fear began to settle in. I did not know where I was, why I was there, or who are these people around me. I tried to touch my face, but I could not. I wanted to go pee but could not get up. Cloth straps held me to the bed inside the iron lung. I may have started to cry, or I may have become agitated. Within minutes, the nurse who had suctioned me was joined by another nurse, obviously a higher ranking one. The higher ranking one, said, "Sedate him." The iron lung was opened, and the nurse turned me on my side and gave me a shot in my butt. The next thing I remembered was that it was daylight. From the mirror above my head in the iron lung, I could see that I was in a room with 12 other iron lungs. I did not know until my mother was allowed to visit me that I was the youngest of the 12. This was the isolation unit. All of us were patients who had been diagnosed within the previous 15 days. Every effort was made to keep the poliovirus from spreading to other parts of the hospital or to other patients. Before coming into the isolation unit, staff prepared in a surgical scrub room. No visitors were allowed into the unit. That included my parents. The nurses did allow me to talk to them on the phone. And on my birthday, my iron lung was rolled over next to a visitor's window where I could see my parents. Otherwise, the unit's isolation was strictly enforced. Since I could not swallow, I was fed through a tube in my nose. Once I asked the nurse whether I could taste the nutritional liquid. She obliged, putting a small drop on my tongue. It was the foulest stuff that I had ever tasted. Iron lungs were mechanical respirators, allowing polio patients the opportunity to breathe. Basically, they were pressure chambers where when the pressure increased, the patient's air was expelled from their lungs. When the pressure was decreased, the lungs expanded, drawing air in. Patients in the iron lungs lay on their backs, looking up toward the ceiling. Above each iron lung was a mirror. It was through the mirror that we encountered the world. Because I was so small, The nurses turned my mirror down at a very acute angle. In the isolation unit, I saw lots of feet, but very few faces. Each Iron Lung had two pairs of extended rubber gloves, basically latex gloves extended to have arms. These arm gloves were how the nurses met my needs. They used them to move me up onto a bedpan to do ABM. They held a urinal for me so I could pee. They used these extended gloves to rub lotion on my body, and to pull up or pull down a blanket. Several times a day, they massaged my legs and my arms. Opening an Iron Lung and, thus breaking its vacuum seal was limited as much as possible. We literally depended on the machines for our lives. Iron lungs wheezed as they moved air in and out. In the relatively small isolation unit, there were 12 different iron lungs, each wheezing at a slightly different cadence. It made for a cacophony of non-rhythmic noise. Additionally, the large heavy-duty industrial air compressors that the iron lungs used made a humming noise. Altogether, it was a very noisy place. When it was determined that I was no longer infectious, I was moved from the small isolation unit to the much larger man's polio ward. If my memory is correct, the ward was U-shaped, and, I think, it had 40 to 50 patients. In one of the legs of the U, the iron lungs were clustered. The other leg had beds for the patients without breathing issues. In between was the large nurse's station. On either side of the nurse's station were two sets of large double doors, one set for coming in and one for going out. In the polio ward, about half of the staff members were males. They were needed because so many of the patients were immobile and strength was required to move them. It was in the polio ward that my parents could visit me. Every evening at 7 p.m., they would be allowed to come into the ward and spend time with me. They brought me presents, mostly books that I could read if my overhead mirror were turned upside down and the book was hooked into the clips. My voracious reading caused problems for the nurses and the attendants. They had to come over to my iron lung, remove the book from the clips, turn the page, and then rehook the clips. But, I consumed the book at a very rapid rate. If they did not come over fast enough, I would bang on the side of my iron lung until they came. I was both the youngest in the ward and the most spoiled. While I was in the iron lung, my hair, which is normally a sandy brown, turned an intense red. My mother once joked that she could easily find me, all she had to do was look for my hair. It grew very long and very curly. One afternoon, the charge nurse decided I needed a haircut, and the attendant buzzed it all off. I was so mad. I yelled at everyone. How would my mother be able to find me without my red hair? Once I had been moved out of the isolation unit, my rehabilitation began. The most important thing was to get me breathing on my own without the assistance of the iron lung. Four times a day, a therapist would open my tube and push on my abdomen to get me to expel the air in my lungs. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. The first sessions were for 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then 30 minutes. Then, one day, they removed me from the iron lung and sat me in a chair. I was out of the lung for a full 45 minutes. A few days later, two attendants that I did not know, they were wearing gray uniforms instead of the usual white, unplugged my iron lung and began moving it and me down a long hallway, then outside to a specially built ambulance. I did not realize it, but I was being moved from Los Angeles General to the Rancho Los Amigos Rehabilitation Hospital in Downey. My condition was no longer considered acute. Rancho Los Amigos, often just called the Ranch, had originally been established as the county's poor farm, where indigent individuals received housing and medical care in exchange for work on the farm. In the 1920s, its purpose was transformed to provide long-term rehabilitative care for TB patients. During the Second World War, its purpose was again shifted to that of long-term rehabilitation for wounded veterans. When the Veterans Administration took over that function, it was transformed into a rehabilitation facility for polio patients. In 1951, a new North Campus was built, tripling the size of the facility. When I arrived in the fall of 1954, it offered space for about 400 patients. It became one of the best polio rehabilitation hospitals in the country. The two gray-clad attendants moved me to Ward 11, the designated ward for school-age boys. There were 18 of us, the youngest was 4 and the oldest was 12. The very first thing the new nurse said to me is, "We're going to get you out of that thing. We don't think you need it anymore." 2 days later, they took me out of my iron lung and then rolled it out into the hallway. When my parents came to visit me that night, they were surprised and incredibly pleased to see me sitting up in a special, padded chair. She was right. I no longer needed it. It would be another month before the surgeons removed my tracheostomy. With it out, I was allowed to go home for 3 days at Christmas. Of course, sending me home meant carrying a large oxygen tank, my special padded chair, a protective rail for my bed, rubber sheets, and the special, pre-softened, food that I was allowed to eat. By Christmas, I was beginning to swallow some. With help, and plenty of patience, I could dispense with the feeding tube. My mother later told me that despite all the extra work, it was her best Christmas ever. I shared earlier that I was diagnosed with bulbospinal poliomyelitis. This meant that the virus attacked both my brainstem, thus affecting my breathing and swallowing, and my spinal cord, thus affecting my large muscles. My spine had a distinctive S-shaped curve, my shoulders were shifted in one direction and my hips were shifted in an opposite direction. For my Christmas trip home, I was fitted with a plaster and gauze body jacket that straightened my S-shaped spine. Even today, body jackets are used to treat scoliosis, only today body jackets are made of lightweight, flexible plastic. Mine was made of plaster of Paris that was literally 1 inch thick. It had 2 steel rods in the back. In the front, they used a circular saw to cut an opening down the length. Every night, my mother would remove my body jacket. Every morning, she would put it back on, slipping in my arms, positioning it correctly, and buckling the leather belt so it would fit tightly. I wore a body jacket from 3rd until 6th grade. Then, I had a few months respite. But, with a growth spurt in 7th grade, I was back into body jackets again. They also put braces on my legs, and for a while, I had a brace for my neck. Dressing me in the morning was like putting clunky armor on a night before battle. It often took 30 to 40 minutes. My body jackets gave me a distinctive identity at my elementary school. The other boys called me Turtleback. It is still a name that hurts me today. Yet, the boys like to play tricks on the new kids who did not know about my plaster armor. "Bet you can't hit this kid in the stomach." The new kid would try, but, of course, they would bang their fist on the body jacket and then recoil in pain. Great joke, as long as it lasted. Leonard Blankenship was bigger and stronger than most of the kids in my class. Leonard drew back his fist and let go with a wallop, however, instead of breaking his fist, he broke my cast. literally shattered it. After he hit me, it was hanging like a sack, not doing what it was designed to do. The very next day, my mother and my aunt drove me up to the ranch to have another made. The technician could not believe that a fifth grader had done so much damage. Turtleback was more than just a name that kids called me. It literally described how limited my range of motion was. I remember that once my younger brother grabbed me and threw me to the ground. I could not get back up. I was trapped just as a turtle is trapped when it is on its back. My abdominal muscles were locked inside the cast and could not get me up. In March 1955, my doctors at Rancho released me from the hospital. I lived at home with my family but returned to the hospital 3 times a week for outpatient services. For me, that primarily meant physical therapy, hot packs, and time in the rehab pool. Everything was designed to increase my muscle strength and my range of motion. Stretch, stretch, stretch. The physical therapy was really painful. I was so twisted, so stiff that my muscles and joints had to be forced. Growth was in small increments, a quarter inch 1 week, a small fraction of a degree the next. Two months after I was released from Rancho, my mother noticed that I was having seizures. I was readmitted to the hospital, only this time instead of being housed in Ward 11 with the other school-aged polio boys, I was placed in a unit for patients recovering from brain injury. My head was shaved and I underwent a battery of neurological examinations. The doctors determined that the seizures were caused by proto-epilepsy. I was treated with a variety of epilepsy drugs and required to wear a football helmet. So, I was an 8-year-old with braces on his legs, a body jacket around his abdomen, a neck brace, and a bright red football helmet, taking some very serious drugs. Still, I was sleeping at home in my own bed, eating meals with my own family, and I felt fully normal. The first of my several prosthetic appliances to disappear from my life was the neck brace. Polio had severely weakened my neck muscles on my left side but had not impacted my neck muscles on my right. With lots of physical therapy, the muscles on my right side became strong enough to hold up my head. The next to go was the football helmet. My previous neurologist left Rancho for his own private practice and my new one did not agree with the original diagnosis of proto-epilepsy. He felt, rather, that the seizures were simply the body's way of normalizing itself after having had to deal with the polio virus. Therefore, no football helmet, no more drugs. My leg braces were always something of a debate among my several orthopedic specialists. I remember a conversation about putting my legs in casts rather than braces, immobilizing them. After what seemed like a million x-rays, the doctors agreed that my leg bones were not twisted, and, thus, would not benefit from casts. I was wearing braces because my legs were not strong enough to allow me to stand. Maybe, instead of metal braces, one doctor suggested, I might benefit more from something softer, maybe just over my knees. They measured my legs and found that my left leg was shorter than my right. Maybe I needed sturdy high-top shoes with orthotics instead of braces. As I said, my doctors had internal debates about the need for leg braces. Meanwhile, the intensive physical therapy continued. Stretch. Stretch. Push. Heel down. Toe up. Kick the ball. Walk. 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 Thank you. Just before Christmas 1955, the doctors decided to remove the leg braces altogether. Removing the bulky braces solved another problem for me. It was difficult for me to urinate while the braces were on. Before I returned to school, when I was still being homeschooled, my mother could loosen the braces so I could do what I had to do. At school, that was not possible. Besides, I was now a fourth grader. No fourth grader wants help going to the bathroom. I have had several people express surprise that I had been a polio patient. One longtime friend told me, I would not have known it. I now believe that the only thing that prevented me from being a lifelong twisted anomaly was my extreme youth. I was young enough so that there was still the flexibility to stretch, to pull, to straighten. Had I been an adult, none of this would have worked. I am today grateful for those therapists, for those nurses, for my mother, rubbing my legs in warm oil, keeping me in the pool an extra 10 minutes, stretching me on those god-awful torture devices. It worked. This morning, 65 years later, I walked 2.5 miles on the treadmill, did 25 wall squats, and then did my regular elastic band tension routine for my arms. Not Olympic-level performance. Yet, I could have been, so easily, one who spent his entire life on a gurney, wholly immobile, frozen, fixed in a single position. Turtleback finally lost his shell one glorious day in February 1957. I was in sixth grade, halfway through the sixth grade to be more exact. My family had moved from West Torrance, less than a mile to the beach, to an unincorporated area that bordered Gardena. I was now attending 223rd Street Elementary in the Los Angeles Unified School District. I was now a 6B student ready, next fall, to enter junior high. After my monthly appointment at Rancho Los Amigos, my orthopedist said, "Well, I think it is time to take this thing off. The scoliosis has stabilized. However, if he has any unexpected growth spurts, we may have to do something, but for now, we can dispense with the body jacket." Losing my turtle back liberated me. I was no longer a prisoner to polio. I was free to do all the things I had always wanted to do. More than anything else, I wanted to play baseball. I had fantasized about playing baseball for years while I watched my friends play Little League. My friend, Bobby Pierce, played second base for the Tigers. Greg Barden was a pitcher for the Red Sox. David Blankenship, Leonard's younger brother, was an outfielder for the Giants. And my classmate, the very arrogant Bobby Marshall, who was certainly not one of my friends, was the league's most valuable player. I lived in a new area where I did not know anyone. Still, there was baseball. Not official Little League, but a recreational league sponsored by the Police Youth Athletic Association. All the coaches were either current or retired cops. My mother found an advertisement in our local newspaper. It cost just $12 to join, and sign-ups were at our local park. I was assigned to the Normandy Park Dons. Their team colors were yellow and green. We would get our hats at the first practice. I could not be more thrilled. I could not think of anything else. I would get to play baseball, hit a home run, catch a fly ball. However, at our first practice, our coaches were less than pleased with me on the team. I could barely run, could not hit even the slow pitches, and fell down trying to field a ball. At the end of that practice, one of the coaches called me over and said, "Son, this is not the team for you. I think you should be playing in the developmental league. I'll call that coach and tell him." I did not initially understand what had happened. When I went to the first practice on my new developmental league team, they did not even have a name, just called Team G. I quickly learned it was the league for the 6-year-olds. I was 12 and was assigned to play with 6-year-olds. Kindergarteners. First graders. Kids who had never played baseball. Did not know anything about the game. They did not even keep score. I was in a league of tiny 6-year-olds where no one even kept score. I was utterly crushed. I do not remember how I came to the idea of becoming a paperboy, delivering newspapers. I remember submitting an application, and being hired to deliver the evening edition of the Long Beach Press-Telegram. My route was just north of my house, covering, in total, just under 4 miles. My paper route ran between Western and Normandy Avenues, and from Artesia Boulevard to 139th Street. Today, that area is heavily developed and very urbanized. Back when I did my paper route, it was sparsely settled with scattered homes surrounded by acreage. As I reflect on it, I am astonished that as a 6th grader, a polio kid who had just undergone 3.5 years of intensive rehabilitation, I was able to ride my bicycle over the long route with 2 large sacks of newspapers attached to my front handlebars. And, I only had two, complaints about a subscriber's newspaper not arriving on time. I made it my practice to put every newspaper onto the subscriber's porch. If I could have thrown straight, that might have been an easier goal. Instead, putting the newspaper on a subscriber's porch meant dismounting from my bike and walking the newspaper to the porch, and then remounting and pedaling to the next stop. My manager would drop the newspapers at my house at about 1:30 in the afternoon. I had to roll them, rubber band them, and then load them in my canvas bags. I would always leave about 2 o'clock. My goal was to have every paper delivered by no later than 4:30 p.m. For 3 full hours, my legs were really working, pedaling my 1-speed J.C. Higgins bike. When I started my route, I had 41 customers. When I was forced to quit, I had 73. I was selected twice as the Press-Telegram Paperboy of the Month. I earned bonuses and tickets to amusement parks, including the Pacific Ocean Park, Marine World, and Knott's Berry Farm. I even earned a one-day trip to Catalina on the big white steamship. The very first time that my family went to Disneyland, I had earned the tickets for me and my brother. I remember buying things, like 45 RPM records. One of my very favorites was Purple People Eater. I played that record until the grooves wore off. Another of my favorites was Splish, Splash, I Was Taking a Bath. I also bought things for my brothers, and for my parents. I bought a charcoal barbecue grill. I must admit it, I can't deny it any longer. Yes, I spent $18 of my earnings to buy a pair of white, suede shoes. Since they were suede, they could not be polished. But for an extra $1.50, I bought a special dusting cloth that dusted a white powder over the scuff marks. You see, I was now rich, and I could leave all that polio stuff behind. I did not forget the humiliation of being cut from the Normandy Park Dons baseball team. They were not even an official little league, just something that they did at that park. That park, which I now wholly avoided. That was actually hard to do since I had customers who lived just on the other side of the park. I rode up a side street and then cut over across the busy street and then back to another street. But I never once had to gaze on that dreaded place. Still, the urge for baseball burned deeply. I decided to recruit my family, friends, and neighbors into a new baseball adventure. I used some of my paper route earnings to buy 12 white t-shirts and several packages of RIT fabric dye. My cousin and I used a trick of melting crayons to make pictures onto the t-shirts before we dyed them. She was a good artist. I had her draw a picture of a pirate on each shirt. I had created my own team, with our own jerseys. The Miller Street Pirates never played an actual game. We gathered in what I thought was an empty field at the end of our street, marked off bases and the pitching mound, and began our first practice, throwing grounders to one another, like I had seen watching Little League. What I did not know was that the supposed empty field really belonged to one of the houses that faced the busy street behind our tract. Our practice lasted 30 to 40 minutes. Then, a man walked over and told us that we could not use the field. He was planning to plow it up and grow something on it. I don't think he ever actually plowed up the field, but we knew that we could not use it. This rejection was not really a problem for me. I had created a team and we each had our own t-shirt, just as good, maybe even better, than the ones worn by the Normandy Park Dons. I kept that t-shirt for years, never wearing it, lest it might get damaged. My brother's did not last as long as mine. I remember seeing it a couple of years later as one of my mom's dusting rags. The summer between my 6th and 7th grades has one more memorable set of events. My Sunday school teacher gave me a scholarship to summer camp. Summer camp was for me a week of so many firsts. It was my first time in the mountains away from my Southern California home. It was the first time sleeping in a sleeping bag. It was the first time I ever showered alongside other guys. It was the first time that I actually read passages from the Bible. It was my first mountain hike, my first volleyball game, my first jet boat ride. It was a week where I was treated just like a normal kid among normal kids. It was also when my lack of coordination and strength became fully apparent. During the volleyball game, I missed shot after shot, and was finally cycled out for a fourth grade girl. On the hike, I became winded and had to rest twice. However, most frustrating was my experience ice skating. I do not know why I even thought I could do it. My family had never taken us either ice skating or to a roller rink. I had never worn skates. I did not know how slippery or how hard ice can be. When we arrived at the ice rink, one of the attendants gave us a brief demonstration, zipping around in circles, going forward and backward. Then we laced up our skates and headed for the ice. On the ice, I immediately fell, managed to get up, and then fell again. The next time, I decided to push myself away from the rail, giving my body a big shove toward the middle of the rink. It worked, I was moving, but I panicked and tried to stop. I literally flew into the air and landed backwards, headfirst. My head made a loud crack as it hit the ice. Momentarily, I lost consciousness. I looked up to see two counselors standing above me, asking what happened. My head started really bleeding. When they sat me up, my nose also started bleeding. One of the male counselors picked me up and carried me to the bleachers that were around the edge of the rink. My head hurt. I was scared. I started crying. They put an ice pack on my head, and one of the women counselors sat with me. The other kids went back to the ice and their afternoon of skating. After a while, the woman counselor, whose name I do not remember, said, "Let's give it another try." She helped me stand and then step onto the ice. However, my legs would not do anything that I told them. One went one way, while the other went another. The counselor called for one of her colleagues to help. One woman held one of my arms and another held my other. Held tightly between them, I never fell again. I was skating, sort of. On the bus back to the camp, I felt embarrassed and ashamed. I felt like everyone was staring at me. There's that boy. The one who can't skate. The one who falls down all the time. That's him, the crybaby. I felt like old Turtleback all over again. I took a seat next to a boy that I did not know. He looked at me and simply said, "Boy, that was some fall." He was simply trying to be friendly, in an honest way. But back then, it felt like an attack. I wanted to punch him. Instead, I started crying. I wanted to go home. I never wanted to go to camp or to ice skate ever again. Fortunately, back in our cabin, my counselor Mac and his boss, the camp director, Lois, intervened. We talked together in private for nearly an hour, missing dinner, and some of our evening free social time. Our conversation was not about ice skating or polio or being angry. Instead, it was about hope and faith. For the first time, what we talked about in church became real to me. On our last night in camp, we all sat around a large fire and shared. I remember giving a brief speech. It must have been pretty good. A week after I returned home from camp, an elderly couple approached my parents about adopting me, offering to pay for my full college education. My parents politely told the well-meaning couple, no. The couple had learned about me from Mac, my former counselor who was their oldest son. The summer between my 6th and my 7th grade was the most memorable of my childhood. In the fall, I began going to Stephen M. White Junior High. Other than having to attend what was labeled an adaptive physical education class, I was a normal kid. I had homeroom, art, social studies, English, mechanical drawing, math, and PE. After school, I did my paper route. I began taking accordion lessons on Saturday mornings. Church and Sunday school were my other activities. Life was good. I had friends, and I noticed that I was getting a bit taller. Then, in November, we returned to Rancho Los Amigos for what was now my quarterly checkups. Unfortunately, that is when my happy little world evaporated completely. I said that I had noticed that I was getting a bit taller. My doctors also noticed, and my sudden growth spurt alarmed them. My scoliosis, the S-curve of my spine, was back. My legs were being twisted outward. My left leg, which was shorter than my right, was being pulled up, increasing the difference between the two. My doctors readmitted me to the hospital. What had been a time of freedom without polio was replaced by plaster body jackets, casts on both my legs, covering up to my hips, and many hours of static stretching. My new home was the all-too-familiar Ward 11. I was angry with my body for failing me. I had felt so normal. I was doing things that I had not been able to do. I was just a regular kid. Now, I was immobilized. I spent my days strapped to a so-called standing board. It was literally a plywood board on adjustable swivel that could go from horizontal to vertical. I could go nowhere. I had no mobility. I could not even go to the bathroom by myself. My return to Rancho Los Amigos lasted until the following February. I now believe that had my doctors been able to continue to treat me, they would have done so for several more years. I was neither strong nor flexible. However, Rancho Los Amigos was no longer permitted to treat me. My family had moved to Orange County. Rancho was funded by Los Angeles County. In the late 1950s, Orange County did not yet have rehabilitative services for children. In February of my 7th grade, my doctors decided that I had made sufficient progress that I could be released. My scoliosis was greatly reduced. My legs were close to the same length. I was growing, but less rapidly than during my growth spurt. They released me without outpatient care. They hoped that my body would continue to right itself from the damage caused by polio, but there was no guarantee. For me, a seventh grader who hated being hospitalized, release simply meant freedom. I would never say the words bulbospinal poliomyelitis again. I was free. I was cured. I was not a polio patient. I was not a polio patient. I was not a polio patient. In 1992, at age 45, I began to have difficulty swallowing. Food, especially salads, would catch in my throat and not go down. I saw my personal physician and she diagnosed me as having post-polio syndrome. She recommended that I join a Kaiser-sponsored study of the syndrome that was headed by a physician from Fairfield. When I joined the study, I was told that there were 43 patients in the study and that I was the youngest, more than a decade younger than the other patients. I was classified as an early onset case. I participated in several muscular and neural tests. They found that my swallowing difficulties were due to the paralysis of the neck muscles on my left side. However, the study's director determined that while I had difficulty swallowing certain foods, that difficulty was not directly attributable to post-polio syndrome. It was her opinion, rather, that I have had difficulty swallowing since my first encounter with polio as a 7-year-old child. The muscles on the left side were paralyzed, so the ones on the right side overcompensated, creating a bizarre, but nonetheless functional, swallowing procedure. To do so, my system created new neural, motor networks, connecting the muscles on my right side with my brainstem in a novel way. The way my physician explained things, it was like the original high-voltage power lines had been destroyed, so my body rigged up a rickety, jerry-rigged alternative pathway. It works, sort of. The new pathways are not as strong as the ones that nature provided, but they work, for a while. However, over time, these rickety, jerry-rigged motor networks begin to break down. They get stuffed between the neurons. The nerves can no longer send the same strong signals, so the muscles stop working efficiently, get weaker, and eventually stop altogether. Strange-shaped foods now caused me problems because the neck muscles on the right side were weakening, which was caused by my jerry-rigged neural, motor pathways breaking down. Here is the unfortunate truth about post-polio syndrome. If a patient was acutely affected by polio, which I was, and then their body generates a substantial recovery, which I did, then the more likely they will experience a more severe impact from post-polio syndrome. That is, the jerry-rigged motor networks that allowed the recovery are, over time, more likely to break down. For me, the signature characteristic that I am experiencing a post-polio episode is extreme fatigue. I liken it to having the flu, only I have no fever, no cough, no intestinal upset. I am just extremely tired. For me, now, these episodes usually only last a day. If I rest for a day when I have one, then I am okay the next day. I was originally diagnosed with post-polio syndrome in 1992. As I write this, it is now nearly 30 years later. I am a rarity. My doctor says that there are now only about 150 of us in California. That is 150 in a population of 39.9 million. If you do the math, we represent 0.00003759 of the population. A sliver of a sliver. Of a sliver. We are the polio survivors, those who caught the dreaded disease before Jonas Salk developed the first polio vaccines. The first widespread inoculations of the new vaccines began in January 1955. I was admitted to Los Angeles General Hospital on October 12, 1954. If the inoculations had begun 90 days earlier, I might not have caught the disease. No tracheostomy. No iron lung. No body jackets. No leg casts. No braces. No stretching and stretching and stretching. No aquatherapy. No hot packs. No turtle back. No post-polio. Still, I have been fortunate. My body found ways to recover many of the functions it lost. I remember my return to Rancho Los Amigos in my 7th grade. I remember being again on Ward 11. There was another patient, one who was 16, but still in an iron lung. He liked to tease me, he called me Jesse James and he liked to say things like, "Hey, Jesse James, you robbed any trains today?" Or, "Hey, Jesse James, you got your 6-gun loaded?" The kind of stupid things that boys say to taunt each other. It is part of the male dominance ritual. Now understand. He is in an iron lung. And I am spending my days strapped to a standing board. One day, I remember him saying, over and over, "I am a bloomin' medical miracle. I am a bloomin' medical miracle. I am a bloomin' medical miracle." His name was Charles Stearns. He was a medical miracle. And, so was I.
Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.